Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 416, titled Fascism, Islamism, and Terrorism, being recorded on July 14th of the year 2003. Before I get into the main body of the broadcast, let me remind you that all of the For the Record programs are being archived on Real Audio by sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent programs are streaming at WFMU.org/Dave Emery. Older programs are available for download only on Real Audio at a longer URL. Links to both the WFMU.org/Dave Emery website and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. Spitfire is a CD and tape duplication service that stocks the various programs that I've done over the years. You can visit their website at spitfirelist.com. There are long, detailed, annotated descriptions of the For the Record programs. I have gotten a couple of weeks behind in the writing, so the full descriptions are only up through program 413. I will be getting those updated presently. So for those of you who may be somewhat frustrated that I haven't gotten the entire written descriptions up for 414 and 415, rest assured those will be done before too much longer. And, well, I guess let's get directly into the main body of tonight's broadcast. Today's broadcast, for those programs that eventually, those stations that eventually air this program during the day, a tip of the hat goes to the Asia Times. That is an English language daily out of Hong Kong. And there was a series that they published in 2002, authored by Mark Erickson, titled Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism. I'm retransposing the title, or transposing the title ever so slightly for the purposes of this broadcast, calling it Fascism, Islamism, and Terrorism. And but I want to make sure that a big tip of the hat goes to the Asia Times. I would also stress that the views of the overlap between fascism and Islamism, and obviously the relationship between Islamism and contemporary terrorism, is one that's subject to interpretation. At least one professional colleague whose view I respect does not think that the thesis presented in this series is valid, although the points of information are valid. The individual points are valid. That obviously is subject to interpretation. One of the interesting things about fascism when one studies it is that there are a lot of different manifestations of what could be generally classified as fascism. And in discussion of September 11th, I have used the term Islamofascism, one that's also been used by a number of other critics or observers. I should also stress that when I use the term Islamofascism, this should not be confused with the usage that other observers have given of that particular term. In particular, there's some right-wing talk show hosts on the West Coast who use the term, and I have used that in a very, very different sense than the one in which I believe they are using that. So with those caveats, let's proceed into this broadcast. It is my opinion that the contemporary manifestations of Islamic extremism are being utilized by what I call the Underground Reich, literally a Third Reich that went underground at the end of World War II, using, above all, the profound capital that was available, the enormous capital that was available to fascism, Nazism in particular, although the same thing also happened in Japan, and utilizing that plus some of the political connections that derived from the onset of the Cold War, because fascism is anti-communist, and because obviously the U.S. and Britain were anti-communist, and with the Cold War occupying center stage on the global geopolitical venue, I guess one could say, not only in Europe but also in Asia, very, very significant capital interests, very much associated with some of the major corporations in Japan and Germany and many of their affiliates in the U.S. and elsewhere, derived directly from the corporate interests that had supported not only Hitler and Mussolini, but also the fascist Japanese and Imperial Japan as well. Within a week or two, I hope to conclude the basic work that I've done on September 11th and related topics. There are certainly a lot of new information coming out, and I will certainly keep listeners updated on new developments vis-a-vis September 11th and related topics, and I'm including the Iraq war in that topic. But there are a number of other things that I want to get to, and I will be getting to those after devoting the better part of 2 years to September 11th and related events. I would note, for the purposes of listeners, before we get into this particular broadcast, that there is a remarkable book out by a pair of authors named Sterling and Peggy Seagraves called The Yamato Dynasty, and I want to make some of the work from that book and also a subsequent volume, which I have yet to obtain, called Gold Warriors. I want to make that the focal point of a number of broadcasts, and so I will be moving on from September 11th very shortly. By the way, I also want to note a correction. I noted this in the description for the broadcast, but in discussing in For the Record program 412, the flight of Martin Bormann and Hitler Youth leader Arthur Oxmann from the Führerbunker, I incorrectly identified Johann von Leers as one of the people who was leaving the Führerbunker with them. Johann von Leers was a key aide to Josef Goebbels, and it was another Goebbels aide, Werner Naumann, who actually fled the Führerbunker with the Bormann Oxmann Party, a book that alleged that French intelligence had information from von Leers that Bormann had survived World War II, was the synapse that basically the point of information that I confused when I basically fused a synapse in that regard. I do view the von Leers links with Werner Naumann and Werner Naumann's links in turn with the Underground Reich, including the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, as of considerable significance in the context of September 11th, because I believe that the Islamist movement, something that certainly predates fascism per se, and is in and of itself a form of religious extremism, has been utilized very effectively, as I've mentioned in a number of programs, as proxy warriors against, at various stages, the United States, the United Kingdom, and in the post-war period, the United States and Israel as well. And I believe that the tremendous capital reserves that were available, largely as a result of the international cartel system that predated World War II and that basically continued during the war and after the war to a considerable extent because of the enormous monies that were available to the Underground Reich. The von Leers' role in the Middle East and in turn von Leers' links to some of the people such as Ahmed Huber and others from the Al-Taqwa Network, something that I view with considerable, I view as being of considerable significance. The elevation, for example, of the book, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, the notorious Okhrana anti-Semitic forgery, which became a mainstay of European fascism and was one of the ideological tenets of Adolf Hitler's anti-Semitism, the post-World War II growth of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion in the Islamic world, I think, is symptomatic of the extent to which the propagandistic utilization of much of the money that was available, or at least some of the monies available to the Underground Reich, and how and the way in which they have manifested themselves in the post-World War II Islamic world, the Arabic world in particular, are of more than passing significance. But again, I want to stress that it was not Johann von Leers, but rather Werner Naumann, who left the Führerbunker with Arthur Oxmann and Martin Bormann. So please note that fused synapse in that context. And note also again that at least one professional colleague whose opinion I respect disagrees with the hypothesis presented here in this four-part series, but with a tip of the hat to that colleague and to others who might disagree, I do think that the author here has made some important points about not only similarities between totalitarian Islam or Islamism, or as I would call it in its post-World War II manifestation, Islamofascism, and more traditional European fascism. This is a four-part series from the Asia Times. Listeners are emphatically encouraged to visit their website at www.atimes.com. And the four-part series is called Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism. It was authored by Mark Erickson. last name Erikson, and appeared in late 2002. The series begins with discussion of the Al-Taqwa Network, and then outlines some of the history of Islamic extremism and how it, during the course of the anti-colonial struggle between the two world wars and during World War II, totalitarian Islam or Islamism became associated with fascism. And I would submit that in its post-war manifestation, in particular the utilization of the supposed worldwide Jewish conspiracy and in the scapegoating of Jews in general and Israel in particular for the grinding social problems that exist in the Arabic world and the Muslim world in general. In this regard, and also in terms of the economic program of the Muslim Brotherhood, a central element of Islamic extremism in the 20th century, I would submit that Islamism, I think, could be viewed very accurately as a form of Islamofascism in the post-World War II period. In part one, we're going to begin with a look at, for veteran listeners, a review of some of the elements that are enmeshed in the Al-Taqwa Network. Then we're going to take a look at some of the history of the association between the Muslim Brotherhood and the fascist powers of Europe. We're going to take a look at the collaboration during the World War II period of Egyptian Green Shirts member Anwar Sadat and the Muslim Brotherhood. The Green Shirts, by the way, were a secular Arabo-fascist organization based in Egypt. We're then going to take a look at the evolution of the totalitarian Islamist philosophy through a guy named Sayyid al-Qutb through Ayman al-Zawahiri. And the author maintains that Sayyid Qutb, whose work has directly influenced Osama bin Laden, basically was carrying on an evolution of totalitarian Islamic thought that had as its main linchpin the Muslim Brotherhood and the ideology of Hassan al-Banna. By the way, Hassan al-Banna was assassinated in 1949, so the Hassan al-Banna, whose name appears as one of the directors of Al-Taqwa, in the article The Shareholders in the Bank of Terror by Lucy Commissar from Salon Magazine of March 15th of 2002 would therefore have been his son or a close relative. Part 1 of Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism by Mark Erickson from the Asia Time reads as follows. Editor's note, as distinct from the world religion of Islam, Islamism, as in part contextually defined below, is a political ideology that adherents would apply to contemporary governance and politics, and which they propagate through political and social activism. On November 7, 2001, on the request of the U.S. government, the Swiss Federal Prosecutor's Office froze the bank accounts of Nada Management, a Lugano-based financial services and consulting firm, and ordered a search and seizure raid on the firm's offices. Police pulled in several of the company's principals for questioning. Nada Management, part of the international Al-Taqwa or Fear of God group, is accused by U.S. Treasury Department investigators of having acted for years as advisors and as a funding conduit for Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda. Among those interrogated by police was a certain Albert Friedrich Armand, a.k.a. Ahmed Huber, 74, a Swiss convert to Islam and retired journalist who sits on the Nada board of directors. Nothing too unusual, perhaps, except for the fact that Huber is also a high-profile neo-Nazi who tirelessly travels the far-right circuit in Europe and the United States. He sees himself as a mediator between radical Islam and what he calls the New Right. Since September 11th, a picture of Osama bin Laden hangs next to one of Adolf Hitler on the wall of his study in Muret, just outside the Swiss capital of Bern. September 11th, says Huber, brought the Radical Islam New Right Alliance together. On that, as his own career amply demonstrates, he is largely wrong. Last year's horrific terrorist acts were gleefully celebrated by Islamists and neo-Nazis alike. Huber boozed it up with young followers in a Bern bar and may have produced closer links. But Islamism and fascism have a long, over 80-year history of collaboration based on shared ideas, practices, and perceived common enemies. They abhor Western decadence, unquote, political liberalism and capitalism, fight holy wars, if needs be suicidal ones, by indiscriminate means, and are bent on the destruction of the Jews and of America and its allies. And again, I believe that this part of the article's perception, this part of the author's perception is absolutely accurate, and I think that some of the economic connections that exist between the petroleum industry and the underground Reich and its economic components, and in turn powerful elements in the United States, have helped to cement this particular alliance. I think that the long-term goals of the events of which September 11th are part concern the economic subjugation and domination of the United States by the underground Reich. Indeed, I believe economics is the central element in this particular struggle. I also should stress that I think that when I refer, when I refer to the Bush administration as a front for the underground Reich, and that's something that I very much believe to be the case, this should not be misunderstood as implying that all or even most of the people in this administration are aware of that. The more time passes, the more I've come to believe that inertia is the dominant element in human affairs. Once people have signed on with any kind of institution, private or governmental, and have established a career with that institution, their vested interests, economic and in terms of personal prestige, rest with the perpetuation of that institution in its fundamentals. And I think that has an awful lot to do with why things work out. I think that most processes of cover-up have to do with many of these institutional connections. Say, for example, one is head of a major company, and if one hires the mafia, say, to break a union or to murder a union leader, that fact of compromise tends to be an instrument of cover-up in and of itself. If, say, the mafia leader then comes and says, look, you've paid me off for having gotten rid of this union leader or this union, now I want 30% of your business. Basically, this leaves the overworld, so to speak, of being in a position of either being compromised or destroyed, or continued collaboration with the elements of the underworld that it has utilized. I believe that the paradigm involved in the machinations of the overworld, so to speak, and the political underworld of the underground Reich is analogous, though not perfect. But again, this last sentence here, speaking of common elements between ideological elements between Islamism and fascism, they abhor Western decadence, unquote, political liberalism and capitalism, fight holy wars, if needs be suicidal ones, by indiscriminate means, and are bent on the destruction of the Jews and of America and its allies. Horst Mahler, once a lawyer for, later a member of, the 1960s and 70s German ultra-left terrorist Baader-Meinhof gang, and now a leading neo-Nazi, summed up convergent radical Islamic and far-right views and hopes in a September 21st, 2001 letter. Quote, by the way, we've talked about Horst Mahler, an associate of Ahmed Huber, in a number of broadcasts, including For the Record 333, and some of our discussions with Kevin Coogan, the brilliant author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey in the Postwar Fascist International. And by the way, that my use of Kevin Coogan's work, just like my use of the works of other authors and writers, should not be misunderstood as constituting an endorsement on their part for the working hypothesis presented on September 11th. Again, I tip my hat to all of the authors whose work I access in this series, but that should not, under any circumstances, be misunderstood by individual listeners as constituting endorsement on the part of those writers for the working hypothesis that I have presented on September 11th. Sadly, I'm afraid that is uniquely mine. I think if Paul Manning were still alive, he would probably come to a similar conclusion. However, we've spoken about Horst Mahler, an associate of Ahmed Huber and the German neo-Nazi NPD, and indeed Horst Mahler is part of the François Genoux fascist Islamist far-left milieu that we've looked at in a number of broadcasts going back a number of different years. Returning once again to Islamism, Fascism, and Terrorism by Mark Erickson, Horst Mahler, once a lawyer for, later a member of, the 1960s and 70s German ultra-left terrorist Baader-Meinhof gang, and now a leading neo-Nazi, summed up convergent radical Islamic and far-right views and hopes in a September 21, 2001 letter. Quote, "The USA, or to be more exact, the world police, has shown itself to be vulnerable. The foreseeable reaction of the East Coast, equal the Jewish controllers and their Gentile allies, equal the U.S. establishment, can be the spark that falls into a powder keg. For decades, the jihad, the holy war, has been the agenda of the Islamic world against the Western value system," unquote. This time, it could break out in earnest. It would be world war that is won with a dagger. The Anglo-American and European employees of the global players, unquote, dispersed throughout the entire world, are, as Osama bin Laden proclaimed a long while ago, military targets. These would be attacked by dagger where they least expected an attack. Only a few need be liquidated in this manner. The survivors will run off like hares into their respective home countries where they belong, unquote. Such convergence of views, methods, and goals goes back to the 1920s when both Islamism and fascism, ideologically pre-shaped in the late 19th century, emerged as organized political movements with the ultimate aim of seizing state power and imposing their ideological and social policy precepts, in which aims fascism, of course, succeeded in the early 20s and 30s in Italy and Germany, respectively, Islamism only in 1979 in Iran, then later in Sudan and Afghanistan. And of some of the ideological similarities between Islamism and fascism, the author goes on, "Both movements claim to be the true representatives of some arcane, idealized religious or ethnically pure communities of days long past. In the case of Islamism, the period of the four righteous caliphs, 632 through 662, notably the rule of Umar bin al-Khattab, 634 through 44, which allegedly exemplifies Din wa Dawla, the unity of religion and state, in the case of the Nazis, the even more obscure Aryan Volksgemeinschaft, with no historical reference point at all. But both are in reality, as historian Daniel Pipes, director of the Middle East Forum, puts it, 20th century outgrowths, radical movements utopian and totalitarian in their outlook. The Iranian scholars Ladan and Roya Burumand, that's spelled B-O-R-O-U-M-A-N-D, have made the same point. The Nazi or National Socialist movement was formed in reaction to the World War I destruction of the Second Reich, the unequal and treasonous, unquote, Versailles Treaty, and the mass social dislocation that followed, its racialist, corporatist ideology laid out in Hitler's Mein Kampf or My Struggle. The Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Ikhwan al-Muslimun, parent organization of numerous Islamist terrorist outfits, was formed in 1928 in reaction to the 1924 abolition of the caliphate by Turkish reformer Kemal Atatürk, drawing the consequences of the World War demise of the Ottoman Empire. Ikhwan founder Hassan al-Banna, an Egyptian schoolteacher, wrote at the time that it was endless contemplation of, quote, the sickness that has reduced the Ummah, or Muslim community, to its present state, unquote, which prompted him and five like-minded followers, all of them in their early 20s, to set up the organization to rectify it. Fascist Nazi history need not be dwelt on further here. It led to the horrors and destruction of World War II and the Holocaust. Neo-Nazism, whether in Europe or the U.S., remains a terrorist threat, and as the French Le Pen version demonstrated in parliamentary elections this year, retains a measure of political clout. It is nonetheless a boxed-in niche force with little capability for breakout. Its ideological twin, Islamism, by sharp contrast, has every chance for wreaking escalating worldwide havoc based on its fast-growing influence among the world's more than 1 billion Muslims. Immediately following September 11th of last year, U.S. President George W. Bush declared war on terrorism. It's a catchy phrase, but a serious misnomer all the same. Terrorism is a method of warfare, not the enemy. The enemy is Islamism. By the way, I would suggest, and speaking only for myself here, that in fact Islamism, or Islamofascism, as I think it could be called, in the post-World War II period, is in my opinion, being used very much like being used basically in much the same fashion as Islamic fighting formations were utilized during the closing stages of World War II by the SS. They're being used here as foot soldiers, and I believe that the long-term goal of the Underground Reich is the economic destruction and consequent subjugation, political and economic, of the United States. I think if circumstances were to warrant it, I believe that Islamism and Islamo-fascist activists would be used to effect the physical destruction of the United States as well, something that would not necessarily require that large a number of people, given the enormous capabilities of weapons of mass destruction and the economic implications of a terrorist incident involving WMDs that would not in and of themselves necessarily wreak that much physical destruction, but the effect on the U.S. economy would be enormous. Continuing, speaking of Hassan al-Banna and the Muslim Brotherhood, al-Banna's Brotherhood, initially limiting itself to spiritual and moral reform, grew at astonishing speed in the 1930s and 1940s after embracing wider political goals, and by the end of World War II had around 500,000 members in Egypt alone and branches throughout the Middle East. Event background, ideology, and method of organizing all account for its improbable success. As the war drew to a close, the time was ripe for an end to British and French colonial rule, and the Ikhwan was ready with the persuasive, religiously buttressed answer. Free the Islamic homeland from foreign, infidel, or kafir control, establish a unified Islamic state, and al-Banna had built a formidable organization to accomplish just that. It featured sophisticated governance structures, sections in charge of different segments of society, peasants, workers, and professionals, units entrusted with key functions, propaganda, press relations, translation, liaison with the Islamic world, and specialized committees for finances and legal affairs, all built on existing social networks, in particular those around mosques and Islamic welfare associations. Weaving of traditional ties into a distinctly modern political structure was at the root of al-Banna's success. But the supreme guide of the Brethren knew that faith, good works, and numbers alone do not a political victory make. Thus, modeled on Mussolini's black shirts, al-Banna much admired Il Duce and soul brother Führer Adolf Hitler. He set up a paramilitary wing, slogan Action, Obedience, and Silence, quite superior to the black shirts Believe, Obey, and Fight, and a secret apparatus, al-Jihaz, al-Siri, and intelligence arm of al-Ikhwan to handle the dirtier side, terrorist attacks, assassinations, and so on, of the struggle for power. In 1948, after the Brotherhood had played a pivotal role in mobilizing volunteers to fight in the war against the Zionists in Palestine to prevent establishment of a Jewish state, it considered itself to have the credibility, political clout, and military might to launch a coup d'etat against the Egyptian monarchy. But that wasn't to be. On December 8, 1948, a watchful Prime Minister Nukrashi Pasha disbanded it. He wasn't watchful enough. Less than 3 weeks later, the Brethren retaliated by assassinating the Prime Minister, in turn prompting the assassination of al-Banna himself by government agents on February 12, 1949. That didn't end it, however. Under a new, more radical leader, Saeed Qutb, the al-Ikhwan fight for state power continued and escalated. A mid-1960s recruit was Ayman al-Zawahiri, present number two man of al-Qaeda and the brains of the organization. And this concludes side one of For the Record program number 416, Fascism, Islamism, and Terrorism, being recorded on July 14th of the year 2003. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.